We had a pirate radio service quite close to this building here in Coolock. Well, it moved around the area. We had a pirate station called North Dublin Community Radio. And as I say, it went through about three or four different locations while we experimented. But yeah, it was quite a small... I had ideas about what it could do. Just briefly to sort of recap for you, in the sort of mid to the late 70s, there were a lot of young men in Dublin. FM transmitters were becoming available, so a lot of them were setting up small commercial radio stations, basically playing music and sending a few ads to local shops. I'm still not interested in the technology other than the social application of it, but it seemed to me, because I was involved with a lot of community projects, and there was always a problem in getting information out to people who maybe would participate or avail of the service, whatever service. I felt there was a good need for if we had a community radio station that would talk about community development issues. So we set up NDCR on that basis, that it would be predicated on the idea of using the tools of radio for community development. Now, we got a lot of young men, particularly with medallions and big boxes of discs and an attitude. We had to beat a lot of them away with a stick. We got too many of them, but we had enough. But it was still very much a music-driven station. I mean, the amount of talk, the amount of community development talk was like in comparison to the overall content. But that was the model of radio that particularly young men, young women maybe had more sense, they didn't seem to be as attractive, but young men definitely found radio allure and wanted to talk to the world and play their favourite music. So it was a basis for starting, but my concept always was that the music would be interspersed with a lot more critical theory content about what the type of society we live in, and a critique of it, and maybe suggestions of possibilities to improve things. So for me, it was always about possibility media, really.
And how did that go down with the young men and their medallions who came with their boxes of LPs and wanted to play their favourite music? Because to what extent were they tuned in with critical media theory about changing the society, or how did you educate people, I suppose, in that sense?
Well, they probably gave up eventually on most of them. But I think they beat me to it. They'd given up on me before that anyway. You know, we would have workshops, and I would try to... I was even introducing media literacy. This was in about 1980. I was doing media literacy because I felt this was a really useful tool for critiquing and exploring media and how media plays with people's minds and the agendas of media. And I was reading Chomsky. I don't know anybody else was reading them, but they humoured me because basically I was finding the money to pay the bills and pay the rent and keep the place open so that they could indulge themselves. So to some extent they said he's an eccentric fool, but at least he's keeping the station on air. I always found some way to keep the thing on air. Plumaz, the landlord, if some of them had done something to annoy him in his building, I'd go and calm the thing down and we'd get another extension of time. So I think they appreciated my efforts in that sense and just sort of decided... These are the medallion brigade. They just decided to write me off as an eccentric, you know. I don't think they knew quite what I was, you know.
But presumably your message was accepted by other people who came in behind you and who agreed with the philosophy of changing society through the media, or of attempting to make people media literate and so on. So presumably you had support for that democratic kind of participative ethos.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't be here, the project wouldn't be here, other than some people came along and liked the sound of it and came back and asked me some more. We built up, I mean, I don't want to be too cynical, we built up quite a good cohort of people very early on. In the early 80s, we had a couple of good journalists liked the idea. They'd interviewed me and found that while they were getting excited with their notebook over coffee and Bewley's, and I was explaining about this alternative media and the right to communicate and all this, and they said, this is brilliant stuff, wait till I write up my article. And I, from bitter experience, would caution, you may not get it past your sub-editor. Usually I'd get a phone call from the journalist embarrassed, saying, they won't run with it, they won't print it, you know. So we were excluded instinctively we were excluded. Offering alternative ways to do media didn't sit well with existing media. But some of those journalists liked what I was saying, and although they couldn't print it, they became involved. So they were important because they were bringing an intellect to it and a worldly sort of wisdom that I needed to surround myself with. So, yeah, very early on, I'd say by 1981, 82, there was a very good working group here who understood that. I think they understood the challenge of what we were trying to do, really, you know.
And what exactly inspired you? Can you tell us, just for the benefit of listeners, a little bit about the philosophy that inspired you back then in 1980, 1981, and that continues to inspire you today in terms of community radio as a tool for development? What exactly does that mean?
Well, I think initially I couldn't even articulate it. I think it just was a sort of an intuition, a sense that here was a technology. And I just happened to have in my company a couple of young men who were setting up little FM radio stations, and they were quite excited. And I saw how simple the technology was and how reasonably priced it was. And I realised this was within our grasp to have an actual radio station that we owned and the content that we could control. So I think it was really, I hadn't articulated, I think it's an odd thing to say, but I think I understood the essence of it before I understood the actual workings of it. I think I had just an intuition that this is something important, that if we use it in a certain way, it will be beneficial to our wider community. And having done that, I then had to backtrack and find out why I had this intuition. What did it actually mean? But I do think I just sensed an essence of what it would be. Now, I fleshed it out over the years by reading a lot and discussing it and travelling to mainly European countries where there's community radio and seeing how they do it. But all the bits fell into place. I mean, the initial essence was true. And I think I've just built a framework. I've sort of built a logic, I suppose, around it now, so that now I can, I suppose, explain it.
What's the logic then that you've worked out over the years? How would you explain that? Who inspired you? What thinkers have brought you to where your idea is today?
It's wide, it's wide, it's wide. Chomsky would be one, Habermas. These would be on the intellectual side. Well, Chomsky would be more the dissident voice, Habermas more the academic voice. But I've tried to incorporate, and I'm not an academic, but I've tried to understand even Habermas, and I mean, I'm reading Heidegger and Wittgenstein, and what I've tried to do is break their ideas and thoughts down to a level where I can absolutely clearly understand it, and I think then I have it at a level where I can present it to colleagues. You know, I sort of deconstruct Habermas or Wittgenstein and so on. So that's been a passion for me for the past 40 years anyway, and I'm still at it. I'm currently writing a long thesis, might be my last thesis, on media and human consciousness and human evolution. Like, I mean, I think the essence I sensed years ago, I'm still fleshing it out. I think I'm nearly there now with a theory of human consciousness and evolution and how communication fits into that, because I do think innately human beings are a sociable species. We like to communicate and we feel distraught if we're cut off from human communication. I think this is an innate characteristic, and I do think that the popularity of social media is a commercial service that is tapping into that need for humans to communicate. I think it's been exploited and misappropriated. Quite frankly, if you want to know, part of my thesis is that commercial media is a misuse of these important communications technologies. Particularly, I think, with climate change, we should be talking to each other across the planet about how we solve these big, big global issues. And I think commercial media is actually, and particularly social media, is getting in the way of a dispersed species talking to itself across the planet. You can see how much I've moved from trying to get an FM transmitter in Coolock 30 years ago.
And what does your theory or your logic mean today for a community like this in Coolock in northeast Dublin?
Well, a lot of it would be that we would do the programme, but we'd be more aware and more conscious and more focused on the, a communication between humans. And I think we've a lot of stuff to, I mean, here in Near FM, we don't actually do the news because we actually didn't want to just cut and paste news from maybe print newspapers or something, because that's the mindset of mainstream media that we're just propagating. And we're struggling at the moment and working through. It's sort of coming to fruition. I think we're going to develop citizen journalism as well, but we want to try and make sure that if citizens in Northeast Dublin are going to feed data, information, facts into us, that they have a broader sense of what that could be also, how to deal with media, how to deal with information. And I worry about bias and objectivity, because I think these are just tools to suppress people's explaining themselves and being more intuitive and instinctive. I think we're subjective beings and we really can't be objective. I nearly lost our last license over this. I went in and spoke to Niall Stokes, who was giving us our license, and I argued with him because they were demanding that we would agree to be objective in our programming content. And I was arguing philosophically with him that, you know, we're objective beings and we can't really do this objectivity stuff. And of course, I was being kicked under the table. Don't annoy him till we get the bloody license, you know. So that was it. So that's the sort of thing I think we're developing. We also have the FELA in Clare at the end of May. This is the training festival that happens every year for CRAIL, the Community Radio Network. And with Tom McSweeney, the journalist, and myself, we're going to do a workshop on social benefit journalism. I got into the last Broadcasting Act in 2009. Well, it was Eamon Ryan was the minister, and I asked him to put into the Act an acknowledgement of the social benefit that community radio provided. But it didn't go in as an acknowledgement, it went in as a stipulation that community radio must provide a social benefit. So it wasn't quite where I'd hoped to place it, but it means that we welcomed it, but I just think it was in the wrong place. But I'm trying to now see, because there is talk now about a bursary maybe for journalism, which local radio will also tap into. But I want to see, can we use this opportunity now to develop a social benefit journalism? It'll take my idea, but I might be able to deposit it in a practical place where there's some money coming into a station if they can do a certain type of, so it won't be getting up in the morning and cutting the headlines out of the Irish Times and reading it back out to the listeners. It'll be a real, we need to reflect on it and think about it carefully, John. But I do think there's a model for, I just have an instinct that there's a model for community journalism that we haven't discovered yet or develop, but I think it's there. I'm absolutely sure it's there. We just need to spend a bit of time working on it.
So this is an alternative to the hourly news headlines on Today FM or even on 98 FM or whatever, a different type of hourly news service. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it would be. I mean, I'm not even sure what it will sound like. I don't know whether it will start off with a jingle as usual, you know, here's the news. It may not do that. But I think at this stage, I have a sense that it's going to be possibilities news, okay? And I'll try and explain that. The idea would be that you don't depress people with news about even climate change or a famine in some African country or another war somewhere in the Middle East, that someone sitting in their community in Ireland has no control over. What can they do about it? They just get depressed and there's an impotent rage, or they get, you know, just they feel apathetic because they know they can't do anything about it. So I think the first thing we can do, and I think it will be a real helpful service to listeners to news, if we can give them a possibilities format. Now, I haven't quite worked it out, but the idea I think would be that we'd present the news, the problem, either local or national or international, and part of the bulletin will talk about possibilities of how to solve it. Okay, so we'll offer possibilities so the listener isn't just left up in the air filled with impotent rage or apathy. There's possibilities to change, and we might even link that news bulletin to local organisations that deal with this particular topic. So if a person is animated by a news item, there may be something they can do about it. So I think that would be, I think it'd be quite a healthy, healing form of news that, and it wouldn't be patronising or not dealing with the hard issues. I think it actually, the challenge will be to absolutely deal with the hard issues, but to find a different way of dealing with them and encouraging every listener to participate in some form that suits them. So that's the sort of model I'm inching towards with Possibility News.
So it's a form of empowering people, I suppose, which is what community radio is supposed to be about in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this would, that's what I'm saying. I think at the moment news disempowers totally. I feel the same myself when I listen to the news bulletins. I mean, I'm engaged with this, with the situation, but I don't know how to solve it as an individual. So I think our news has to be a healthier form of news. It has to be richer, and it has to show people that, that there are ways for you, if you're engaged, you can be animated and you can do something about it. So I think it'll be healthier for people's psyche as well if they have a news bulletin that doesn't just leave them sitting there fuming.
Can I go back to the period of NDCR and the, of course, NDCR, like all other stations, had to go off the air at the end of 1988. And then there was a hiatus before Near FM was licensed. Yeah. So what were the people who had been involved with NDCR, yourself and colleagues, what were you doing in those intervening years to keep the keep the spirit of community radio alive when you couldn't actually broadcast?
Well, that was I think at that stage we were lucky that we had sort of coalesced a group of people who liked the idea. The DJs wandered off, took their medallions and their boxes of records, and they found maybe there were still one or two pirate radio stations on. So they were never going to stay with us because they didn't ever understand what we were doing. If they're out there today, good luck. I hope you're all doing well, and hope your medallions haven't rusted. But there was a small cohort that liked what we were doing, and we met. We had a monthly meeting with a committee of management that met in embryo with no radio station, no prospect. I mean, Ray Burke at the time was the minister, and he assured me that, because I was chair of the NACB, which was the before CRAIL, was the original organisation. We met with him, and he assured me that he just wanted to get the commercial radio, local radio, on air first and give them a little bit of time to bed down, and then he would turn his attention to community radio. And of course, as we know, it was never going to happen. And it did. It took Michael D. Higgins as Minister for Communications, and as I say, I acknowledge him anytime I'm talking about it to people. I didn't even have to explain community radio to Michael D. He understood it instinctively. He understood it. It was great to meet a politician who absolutely had enough intelligence and integrity to understand this model of media that none of the others. I'd talked about half a dozen ministers before that who scratched their heads and what is he on about. So Michael D. was great, and as I said, it sort of broke the logjam, and then we got the pilots in 95. But in the interim, we had quite a few years of nothing to do, so we just held workshops. But we met monthly. We were very formal. We had minutes, and we met monthly, and we planned, and we did fundraising, and we would do sort of publicity activities to keep the idea alive in the area. So we kept active, but it wasn't easy to keep the enthusiasm and the momentum going when there was no sign at all for several years that we were ever going to get licenses. It looked pretty bad at one stage, but we kept going because I think the group I had with me at that stage had grasped the idea and felt it was worth pursuing, and I think that just kept us going.
And when did Near FM then, as we know it today, when did it begin to broadcast? Well, first of all, I suppose there was a pilot stage, wasn't there?
That's right. When we finally got the go-ahead, I mean, it was the IRTC at the time, or the BCI, I think it was called. They decided they would run a pilot service just to try. So some of the more active community pirates applied. So there was Kilkenny and ourselves, Connemara. There was about four or five stations in Dublin, one in Finglas that collapsed very quickly. But the five stations set up anyway to pilot what community radio, because again, the authority hadn't a clue, didn't know what it was. They didn't actually know what this animal was at all that we were proposing to them. So we ran it, and as I say, it worked quite well. I mean, we didn't cause upheavals and revolutions. It was quite mild. I often remember when I went in to see the first, well, I was actually the first person in to see the IRTC when it formed, and they were asking me, they were all frowning at me, what would community radio be? They couldn't figure, and I was it safe radio? I talked about the Boy Scouts and the Girl Guides when they went off for a weekend, and when they came back, so they could go on air and talk about, and I don't know whether it sounded even more obscure to them, but I thought that must be safe radio. You know, I wasn't saying we'd have Trotsky seminars or anything. So, but that was it. We got on air anyway, and we ran it. And as I say, only one collapse. So at the end of the pilot period, I think it was 18 months pilot period, they they were satisfied. One, we weren't totally troublemakers, and two, it just seemed to be a smaller version of local radio. And I do have to say that at one stage, while I was aggrieved with Ray Bourque, because a lot of the stations that were in the NACB and the model of community radio that we were talking about wasn't my model. Mine was still my essence that was bubbling away somewhere, my subconscious. Most of them were talking about what has emerged finally as local radio. So there's a news bulletin, the drive time, interviews, some music, sell a few ads. And I was actually happy in a way. It's amazing how you can sort of assuage your anger by time. I knew the Bell Ray had shafted us, but I said, that's okay. So local radio has now sort of stolen our clothes, you know. So we need to go back to the drawing board. I said to this group, we have to find a different model if we're going to justify getting on air. We can't just say we'll do local radio light. We have to be. So they were all scratching their heads because this was their model. So it gave me an opportunity, a bit of a chink, to start talking about other alternative. What could we do that's different to local radio? So to that extent, I was happy that when we got the licences, certainly here, my group had spent several years exploring alternative ways to do radio. Some of it, as I say, has come through. I'd like more of it here, quite frankly, in there. But in general, we're quite a progressive station. I mean, we've good connections and links to progressive community media across the planet and across Europe. So we were ready with a programming format when we got going. So, and I think we've developed it since. I mean, it's never going to satisfy me. I'm just one of those mavericks that wants more and more of the same thing. It probably is as well that there's people here with a bit more sort of balance, because maybe by the time, if I was totally in control of programming, it might not be really listenable to, really. And I accept that. So I tend to accept that there's need for music, and we do a lot of community news and current affairs stuff, and we cover a lot of local organisations and give them a voice. So it's a good model, but I think there's still a little bit more tweaking that could be done to take it to the next level. So I'm still hoping to get it to the next level. So watch this space.